Hi everyone, and welcome back to this podcast series on the life of Lucius Annaeus Seneca. This is podcast 20, The Empress and the Green Prefect. Okay, in the last podcast, we heard how Seneca, along with Burrus, the Praetorian Guard commander, was struggling to rein in the excesses of the young Emperor Nero. Seneca's erstwhile patroness, Agrippina, thwarted in her ambition to become the power behind the throne, had been ejected from the imperial palace, had her bodyguard removed, and was being avoided by many of Rome's more influential families. Some of those families, smelling blood, now tried to deal the death blow by attempting to implicate the ex-empress in a plot to replace her own son. But Agrippina wasn't going down without a fight, and she managed to win a small respite from Nero's growing animosity towards her by successfully defending herself against the charges. Having hung a massive guilt trip on her son by questioning how he could ever have suspected his dear old mum of wanting Nero ousted, she had, after all, risked everything to get him the job in the first place. It would seem that the emperor allowed her a little leeway to take revenge on some of her accusers by permitting her to have a say on who was to occupy a few of the municipal posts around the city. Now, Seneca probably had nothing to do with the accusations levelled against Agrippina. They came from patrician families she'd hacked off when she was Queen Bitch. But it seems to me that she would have still been smarting from coming off second best when she and Seneca last locked horns, so she took full advantage of the new opportunity she'd been given and decided to get her own back and take an indirect swipe at Seneca by removing his father-in-law, Pompeius Paulinus, from the prestigious role of Praefectus Annonae, the official in charge of Rome's grain supply. She replaced him with one of her own supporters, and that, I think, provoked Seneca into responding by writing his work De Brevitate Vitae, or On the Shortness of Life. In a nutshell, De Brevitate Vitae is an attempt by Seneca to persuade his addressee, Paulinus, his father-in-law, that giving up his position as the Praefectus Annonae, a very sought-after role, in favour of a life devoted to philosophical study, is a very splendid, desirable, and noble thing to do. Seneca's tone in the book makes it sound as if Paulinus actually has a choice about whether to opt out of the political rat race for a life of edifying leisure, but I'm going to argue that simply wasn't the case, because there's just too much going on behind the scenes in that book. I'd better start, though, by going through a couple of possible problems with what I'm about to discuss. Namely, A, is the Paulinus to whom the book is addressed really Seneca's father-in-law? And B, was De Brevitate Vitae composed as a reaction to the events of AD 56? So firstly, let's take the addressee, Paulinus. Now, Seneca never gives us his addressee's full name in his book, so it's impossible to be certain, but he's generally thought to be Pompeius Paulinus, the father of Seneca's wife, Pompeia Paulina, and he was the man who held the position of Praefectus Annonae, which literally means prefect of the year's crops, from around AD 48-49 to AD 55, and those timings fit nicely with my theory, as he would have been appointed at around the time Seneca was recalled from exile, that is, shortly after Agrippina had replaced Messalina as Claudius's empress, and it was part of her establishing her own people in positions of power around the city, much in the same way as she'd made Seneca tutor to her son Nero, and a few years later, Burrus being made the Praetorian commander. So we can make the assumption that Paulinus was either already a supporter of Agrippina, or he received the position because he was a relative of Seneca's. A close reading of De Brevitate Vitae, though, doesn't reveal definitively that it is that particular Paulinus whom Seneca is exhorting to quit his very prominent job, and nor that the time frame we are dealing with is the mid-1850s. And that's because the language that Seneca uses when talking about Paulinus's job is actually pretty vague. He never states outright that his Paulinus is the Praefectus Annonae, only that he had been involved in provisions distribution duties in Rome at an inferred high level for some while. And as regards when it was written, the book can be safely dated to after the Emperor Caligula's death in AD 41, because Seneca would never have dared to lavish the slagging he does on that lunatic in De Brevitate Vitae when Caligula was still alive. So far, so good. But the main fly in the ointment, as far as dating is concerned, is a reference in the book to the pomerium, which literally comes from the Latin words post muerium, or behind the walls, which was a sacred physical boundary within which the city of Rome was officially confined. Seneca writes that the last Roman to extend that boundary was the dictator Sulla, and that happened in 80 BC, and yet it's documented that the Emperor Claudius also extended the pomerium in AD 49, meaning that there's a case for De Brevitate Vitae to have been composed before that event. Now that could throw a potential spanner in the works of my theory that the work was compiled in AD 55-56, but for now, let's assume that Seneca deliberately passed over Claudius's extension of the pomerium, and I'll attempt to explain why he did that a little later on in this podcast. So, there are questions hanging over who the Paulinus of De Brevitate Vitae is and when it was written, but I'm going to appeal to the book's structure and tone and Seneca's use of quotes from other authors, which I've argued in previous podcasts gives a lot away, to pin the work to the events of AD 55-56. So the first half or so of the work is a pretty standard philosophical treatment of the perception or misperception of the length of life. Ancient Greek sources are thrown in here and there to help explain the relativity of lifespans in different species. That is, the mayfly packs as much experience into its 24 short hours as does a human in 70 years, and so on and so forth. Philosophically, it's nothing new. In fact, the work may even have started out as a standard philosophical treatment of a well-raked-over topic. Seneca using his new elevated status as a platform from which to include his own name among the great thinkers. And he even makes the odd cock-up, such as when he wrongly attributes a quote to Aristotle that actually came from that Greek's pupil and successor, Theophrastus. But that aside, De Brevitate Vitae is also liberally sprinkled with standard Stoic fist-thumping rhetoric about not frittering away the time you've been given in life, but to use it productively by acquiring useful knowledge and doing elevating things. And again, there's nothing too out of the ordinary there. But then something must have happened, because the further into the work you go, the more personal the whole thing becomes. It's almost as if Seneca has spotted an opportunity to twist something he has already been working on into a new and urgent situation that has arisen, because all of a sudden the Greek references dry up completely and all the citations become Roman. Cicero, Fabianus Papirius, Virgil, even the great Augustus himself. And we've seen before that when Seneca starts to Romanize his literary environment, it means he's getting political. Now, he'd probably roll in his grave, or his ashes would swirl in his funerary urn or whatever, to hear me say this, but a very amusing byproduct of Seneca switching focus to his immediate surroundings are some wonderful insights into his contemporary city of Rome, because he starts to make sarcastic comments about some of his pet hates, and it seems that what got up the noses of the more traditionally minded citizens of Seneca's time was exactly what gets up the noses of the more conservatively minded citizens of today. In one place, for instance, Seneca moans about men getting overly fussy about their hair and getting stroppy with the barber if their ringlets didn't cascade in a certain manner. And music too, then as now, was fertile ground for lots of disapproving eye-rolling, because Seneca bitches about people strolling around, snapping their fingers, and humming along to a simple tune they butchered out of all recognition. And that's even when they were on their way to serious business. So I suppose some things never change. But back now to the book's flow. And eventually Seneca switches away from philosophical moaning and groaning and onto an outright direct and personal appeal to Paulinus. Stepping away from your job is a good thing, he tells him. What's a pedigree racehorse like you doing in a job for a yoked beast of burden? Turn your abundant energies into elevating your mind, he urges. You'll be much better off. Somehow, De Brevitate Vitae has veered off from being a standard philosophical ear-bashing into some kind of personally directed moral support for a single individual. In other words, the book has become a consolatio, a consolation piece. And we've seen Seneca twist that genre to his own ends before, all of them political ends. In the consolation to Marcia, he used the death of his addressee's son to mask his own political propaganda. In the consolation to Polybius, he used the death of his addressee's brother to mask an appeal to be recalled from exile on Corsica. In the consolation to Helvia, he used his own death, in inverted commas, in exile, to broadcast his allegiance to Agrippina and to promote her public image. In this latter part of De Brevitate Vitae, which we may as well call the Consolatio ad Paulinum, the consolation to Paulinus, Seneca is using what we may term the death of a job to, I think, give his now estranged patroness Agrippina one more proverbial kick in the teeth. And I'll come to why I think that in a minute. So why am I calling the latter part of the book a consolatio? Well, like a consolatio, it's focused on one particular named individual at a time of great change in that individual's life. Seneca has to persuade Paulinus that it is morally advantageous to put any disappointment at losing his job into perspective and to abandon the negativity of regret. In other words, Seneca is trying to convince Paulinus that it will be to the benefit of his very soul to step down from what must have been one of the most sought-after jobs in Rome. But stepping away from a prestigious job was something that no patrician Roman was going to do lightly. It simply wasn't in their DNA. So then, let's take a closer look at the role of praefectus and onae. There can be no doubt that it was a big, prestigious, influential position. The man who controlled the crop supply to the Roman world's largest and most influential city was a man of gravitas, auctoritas, dignitas, a man to be looked up to, whose favour and approval would have been eagerly sought. In fact, the former praefectus and onae, one Gaius Turanius, having been relieved of his position several years previously by Caligula because of his age, apparently was in his 90s, made such a song and dance about it by having his slaves and family enact his fake funeral every single day that he was eventually reappointed. So let's make this absolutely clear. Being praefectus onae was not a position that a patrician Roman could walk away from lightly. It was simply not in his genetic makeup to do so. No, if Paulinus was leaving his job to take up a life of philosophical self-edification, rather than, for instance, some other prestigious post, such as a lucrative provincial governorship, then you can bet your bottom dollar he didn't jump, but was pushed. Which all means that Seneca attempting to make it sound that Paulinus had any say in being dumped from his job was a massive front. The switch to Roman citations, and even they die out before the last third of the book, and a purely Roman, and not just Roman, but contemporary context, tells me that Seneca wanted his own voice and message to be heard publicly in the last and therefore most important part of the work. Because let's not forget, De Brevitate Vitae may have been individually addressed to Paulinus, but it was intended to be published and therefore widely distributed and read. Yes, De Brevitate Vitae may well have been the act of a dutiful son-in-law trying to soften the blow of what must have been a rather public humiliation for his father-in-law Paulinus, but, as always with Seneca, hidden inside the sheath of a published consolation was a political dagger, and that dagger was intended for Agrippina. How so? Well, another consideration that tells me that De Brevitate Vitae is a politically loaded work is that Seneca had already written a book on retirement from public office, De Altior. So why bother repeating himself unless he had a very specific purpose in mind? With that in mind, one of the stranger aspects of De Brevitate Vitae is that Seneca doesn't just attempt to persuade his father-in-law that retirement from public office is a fantastic opportunity. He also goes out of his way to state, in no uncertain terms, that the job Paulinus had been doing for the last however many years, master of the corn supply, is a rubbish job. Now, if the job were that bad, then why on earth didn't Seneca say something before? Why did he wait until now to tell Paulinus, his own father-in-law, that he was wasting his time in a dead-end role? And why go to all the effort of broadcasting how crap the office of Praefectus Annonae was to the whole literate Roman world by publishing De Brevitate Vitae? In my opinion, there's only one answer to that. De Brevitate Vitae is a deliberate and cynical attempt by Seneca to actively demote the station of Praefectus Annonae and dilute its prestige in a very, very public way. Seneca even goes as far as to associate the name of the reviled Gaius, that's Caligula, with the position of Praefectus Annonae by reminding his readership about the acute grain shortage of the year that emperor had diverted most of Rome's resources to one of his more spectacularly stupid and wasteful stunts. But why now? What did Seneca have to gain by so publicly allowing his father-in-law to save face by pretending he was gracefully stepping away from a prestigious role from which he was in all likelihood ejected, and at the same time slagging off the role of Praefectus Annonae as a lesser office suited only to dullards and plodders? Well, I think the answer to that lies in the identity of the man who took over Paulinus's role as Praefectus Annonae. In his annals for AD 56, Tacitus, one of the more reliable of the ancient commentators, names Fineus Rufus as the man who was given control of the grain supply around that time. He says that it was during a period when Agrippina had successfully defended herself against accusations of a plot against Nero, as a reward for which, it's implied, she was allowed to reward her supporters and take revenge on her accusers. We've already established that by the end of AD 55, Agrippina was on the out, and that Seneca and Burrus had dumped their erstwhile patroness and put all their eggs in Nero's basket. But although Seneca and Burrus held the upper hand in the power struggle, Agrippina was the daughter of the publicly revered Germanicus, and even now commanded a faction of popular sympathy. She may have lost the battle to become the power behind the throne, but she still wielded some influence. So for me then, the ousting of Seneca's father-in-law, Pompeius Paulinus, from the position of Praefectus Annonae, and his replacement with her own appointee, Fineus Rufus, was Agrippina taking what little revenge she could on Seneca himself, the man who had done her so much harm and betrayed her. and there was probably little Seneca could do to prevent his father-in-law getting the boot. Nero likely saw the whole thing as making a small concession to the mother he'd kicked out of the palace in order to stop her meddling in anything more important. In other words, he chucked her a bone. And Seneca, by this time, had realised that Nero was becoming too volatile to insist he reverse the decision. So Seneca reacted as he always did in times like this. He wrote a book, De Brevitate Vitae. In it, he broadcast to the Roman world that the office of Praefectus Annoni was one bereft of prestige, a thankless job suitable only for dullards, plodders, and washed-up old has-beens at the end of their political careers, the implication being that his own father-in-law was well out of it and could now aspire to loftier ideals. Seneca was employing his stylus to thumb his nose at Agrippina, telling her that she and her creature, Fineus Rufus, with his mundane office of master of the corn supply, were inconsequential in the broader context of imperial politics. And remember that everything that came from Seneca's stylus would have been avidly gobbled up, because he was seen as having the emperor's ear, and it was well to understand the thinking of the man who advised the boy who ran the world. And what about that thorny question I mentioned earlier of Seneca not mentioning Claudius being the last Roman to extend the sacred pomerium around the city of Rome? Well, I think there may be two reasons for that. The first is that although I feel Seneca was not personally hostile towards Claudius, everything he was now writing was geared towards legitimizing Nero and not Claudius as the true heir of the great Augustus, a letter written by whom, incidentally, Seneca had quoted at length in De Brevitate Vitae. So he was, to an extent, delegitimizing some of Claudius's acts, especially ones like extending the pomerium that touched on the holiness, the sacredness of the city of Rome itself. The second reason is linked to the first, and I believe Seneca enlarging on a bit of fun he poked at Claudius in his lampooning of that emperor in the Apocolican Ptosis. In that satire, Seneca had made a big thing about Claudius having been born in Lugdunum, that's modern-day Lyon, France, in the province of Gallia Narbonensis, and because of which Seneca had termed Claudius a Gallus, that is Gallic or a Gaul. But Gallus is also the Latin word for a rooster or cockerel, something that Seneca delighted in employing as a derogatory pun. In other words, he was implying that Claudius was a bit of a cock. In De Brevitate Vitae, then, Seneca was pointing out, without having to explicitly state it, that although Claudius may well have extended the pomerium in AD 49, he was not the last Roman to have done so. And a bit of verbal sleight of hand like that would have been such a very, very Senecan thing to do. And just before we leave De Brevitate Vitae behind, I've got one last comment on the title of the book, On the Shortness of Life. You see, Seneca, I believe, was not above leaving little hints and threats in his works, and we'll come to one later in this podcast series in which that habit was very obvious. So if I am correct, and this book was a response to Agrippina's little revenge in late AD 55, early 56, then I can't help but feel that the book's title may also have been a veiled allusion to the short life of Britannicus, a shot across Agrippina's bowels, a subtle warning even. See, look what happened last time you tried to interfere in imperial power games. So let's wind this podcast up now. Agrippina still had some influence, but her power was waning fast. Even the Praetorians, famously loyal to the children of Germanicus, would avoid her if she were out and about in public. Nero was going to the dark side at obscene speed, while Seneca and Burrus had the tiger by its tail, but seemed at a loss what to do next. The ancient commentaries, many historians, make it sound as if things didn't really start turning to custard for Seneca for another couple of years. But in my opinion, he was on a hide into nothing right from the moment he realised that trying to create in Nero the ideal of a philosopher king was a bit like nailing jelly, that is, it was never going to work. So should Seneca have bailed out there and then before it got too late? Or did his arrogance tell him he could still influence the young emperor? There was also the growing problem that Seneca had his own public image to manage. As Nero's supposedly closest advisor, he had riches, property, and honours lavished upon him, and as far as the public could see, he was living the high life. And, an aside for now, but something I'll come to in a later podcast, Seneca was using some of that newfound wealth to invest heavily in the new and expanding province of Britannia. Moreover, rumour was beginning to circulate about the increasingly dissolute lifestyle going on behind palace walls, in which Seneca was assumed to be taking part. All of this flew in the face of the austere, almost Spartan life of measured restraint and moral self-control that were the hallmarks of the Stoic Sapiens or wise man that Seneca extolled in his works. So it was only a matter of time before the accusations of hypocrisy would start to fly and Seneca's carefully constructed reputation blow up in his face. In AD 56, with his appointment as Suffect consul, Seneca's star had reached its zenith. From now on in, it would be a fight for survival, an ever more intricate dance on the edge of the abyss. In the next podcast, we'll look at the events of AD 57 and AD 58. As Nero's behaviour worsened still further, Agrippina began to fear for her life, and Seneca was outed as a hypocrite and adulterer, but came back with one of the most brilliant literary defences you will ever read. And so I hope you'll join me there.